Welcome to For the Love of Conversation, the podcast that grew out of 3 Minute Storyteller, where we believe conversations connect us and social change begins with the stories we tell. At 3 Minute Storyteller, we share digital stories, video snippets of intimate, messy, expansive conversations with a wildly eclectic bunch of artists, scientists, leaders of all stripes, all who are legendary change agents. Some you may know, and hopefully many you don't. This podcast is the opportunity to bring you into the full conversation. I'm Shannon Mannon, along with my husband Mike and our VW bus Scarlett, who we've outfitted into an awesome mobile storytelling unit. We invite you into the full conversation with us. We're so glad you're along for the ride. We're living in a time of intense cultural upheaval. I find myself regularly turning to certain voices to help me make sense of what's happening. Leaders who see what the rest of us miss and find the through lines in the chaos and bring to light the implications of those connections. Rebecca Traister is definitely one of those key voices for me, and her award-winning columns for New York Magazine are harbors in the storm that provide much needed wisdom and perspective during this explosive moment. We had our conversation a few weeks after my oldest started middle school. I was honestly in the throes of sixth grade girls' llama drama. It was so painful listening and watching and hearing these stories of these beautiful young girls navigating the bruising social stratification that apparently happens when three schools converge into one. In preparation for my conversation with Rebecca, I was listening to an interview where she said that historically in the United States, the only place women have been able to freely express their anger without fear of dangerous consequences is toward each other. And it hit me. It suddenly made all the sense in the world why watching these girls tear each other down had triggered me so deeply. Because I knew deep inside it didn't have to be this way. If we just learn how much power our anger has, we could harness it for incredible good. And we'll no longer siphon off this transformative force for purposes that no longer serve us as women. Traister writes in her latest book, Good and Mad, The Revolutionary Power of Women's Anger, which in unbelievable synergy was released the same week as the Kavanaugh hearings, which of course unleashed a torrent of female rage across our nation. She writes, what becomes clear when we look to the past with an eye to the future is the discouragement of women's anger via silencing, erasure, and repression stems from the correct understanding of those in power that in the fury of women lies the power to change the world. Normally when I have these conversations, it's a broad level overview. It's like a really high level time to process and be reflective of like a human condition. Right. And your writing in your book and where you are at right now is incredibly uncanny in our cultural moment. So how are you kind of processing that in real time?
You mean personally, how am I processing it?
Both.
Well, there was an interest, as I was writing this book, which is about the political consequence of women's anger, I had intended to write it over several years, and it was gonna be actually a kind of calm book, which is funny if, you know, considering that it was gonna be a book about women's anger and valuing women's anger as politically disruptive. The idea was that I would continue without ceasing in my full-time job as a political journalist, and I would write this on the side. I would sort of be keeping track of the ways that women's anger was erupting during the Trump administration because I did feel like it was going to be politically consequential. And what happened is that during the first year of writing about this, the first year of the Trump administration, the fire was so bright and hot and moving so quickly through my professional world, through my social life, in me, but in so many women across the country, and I was seeing so many new forms of activism, so many new ways in which women were willing to raise their voices in dissent, from the teacher strikes in states where striking is illegal, the Me Too movement, the women who were behind the protests of the healthcare repeal, the women who rushed to the airports to protest the travel ban, the young female high school students who were yelling and crying in public and saying, you know, we call BS. Obviously, the Women's March and the number of women flooding into elected office, into political campaigns, I realized that there was something alive and vivid and urgent about this story that I thought I was going to tell slowly. And so I realized I had to write quickly. And it was an incredibly visceral experience of realizing I had to write quickly because I did want it to come out. I wanted it to come out in the fall. I wanted it to come out before the midterm elections, in part because I felt like this is all erupting all around us, but nobody's really making sense of it. Nobody's pointing out that it's all connected. In part because we don't take women's anger seriously as a political force, there isn't a lot in a mainstream political media that's saying, look, that thing that happened, the women's marches, there you can draw a direct line between all these forms of protest and women running for office and the Me Too movement, and this is all of a piece. And beyond that, you can draw the line between all of this and the kind of eruptions of fury that were happening in advance of the 2016 election. Black Lives Matter, slut walks, Occupy Wall Street, you know, the eruption of fury from less powerful people in the United States. Many of them women. This is a story to be told about America and it's and a move to change it and to transform it. And I really wanted to be able to tell that story in its kind of heat and intensity because we are so discomforted by disruptive anger of the masses that we quickly cover it over so we forget what it felt like because it can be incredibly uncomfortable. So I wrote it very quickly, and during the months that I was writing it, so many times I felt like, oh, if only the book were out now, this is the thing I'm trying to explain. You know, again, whether it was the teacher strikers or whether it was the women protesting the immigration policy of family separation in foil blankets in the Senate office building, and they were joined by senators, cheered on by Elizabeth Warren and Kirsten Gillibrand and Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal. And what did it mean that the women who were in power were joining with the protesters of power? You know, there were so many instances where I thought, I wish that I could have this book out right now. And then as it happens, the book is coming out in the weeks, days after the testimony of Dr. Christine Blasey Ford against Brett Kavanaugh, that of course goes back to Anita Hill's testimony 27 years earlier, that goes back to the Supreme Court decision that sexual harassment was not permitted under the Civil Rights Act. That was 1986. Those are based on cases that were lodged by women of color in 1975 who were borrowing from civil rights law and new laws about racial discrimination and applying them to gendered inequity. And they brought their cases about sexual harassment in the mid-1970s that led to the 1986 ruling that undergirded Anita Hill's testimony that, you know, resulted in, you know, Clarence Thomas got confirmed to the Supreme Court, and yet the fury that women felt in response to Anita Hill's testimony provoked so many of them to run for office that the next year, 1992, became the year of the woman. We saw women entering politics in new numbers. And now here, 27 years later, there's another through line that gets us to where we are. And then this book that's trying to tell this story is coming out at the moment that, you know, this testimony is being heard, that the powerful Republican men, the white men who are on the Senate Judiciary Committee, were deliberating about whether or not to vote him out of committee when the Senate itself is going to vote about whether to confirm Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court, a court that's going to determine how much power and autonomy and what kind of rights and opportunities so many Americans, so many vulnerable Americans have for the coming generation and more. It just, everything's so urgent and fraught and visceral right now. And it feels, I'm glad to be publishing the book in the middle of this period, but it also, it feels like being on a rocket ship. Things are moving so fast and it's so perilous at every turn.
I want to talk about when we allow ourselves to feel rage, it drives us to sit on that and do nothing can be, I think, perilous to our health mm-hmm. and well-being on an individual level. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in your book, you write a lot about activism, a lot about the action that the righteous anger that fuels action and activism. Mm-hmm. And that's really necessary, that action part. It requires courage. It requires support. It requires white women, especially, you know, of which I am one, to who may not have the history that our sisters of color have had in activism and in creating systems of support and in having communities of that help us with our courage mm-hmm. and our moral courage. So I just wanted to talk about that aspect. Just how do you see the support networks, the cost that you are very compassionately right about? The rewards will be great, but there is a cost. There may be a cost for some of us, and for some of us, the cost is higher than others. But the courage that's required in this real change of how women...
I think that there are all kinds of incentives offered to women. Those incentives vary depending on their race. But there are all kinds of messages to women to not be angry, to suppress their anger. We are told in a million different ways that if we speak or act out of fury, we will not be taken seriously. We will undermine our own position. Our points will sound illegitimate because we'll sound unhinged or crazy or like babies throwing temper tantrums or like silly, over-emotional women. And so there is the impulse to sit on and swallow that anger. And that's hard, and it creates all kinds of bad effects, frustrations. I think we find other ways to channel the rage. I think it's detrimental to women's health to not be permitted the full range of human expression that men are permitted and encouraged. But there's also an ease, because if you're not acting out of your anger, if your anger isn't spurring participation in projects to change the things that make you angry, then you, in some ways, you're not incurring the costs of being in that angry fray. You're not risking defeat, and because you're not playing, participating, and you're not doing the work. The hard, hard work of engaging in often contentious dialogue with other people with whom you are in coalition, but between whom there are staggering inequities and internal angers and resentments that we all have to voice and face and take responsibility for. And I think that as women become angry, and in the past 2 years, we've seen a lot of particularly white middle-class women who have previously been politically apathetic or to some degree inactive, roused by their rage to civic participation. And there are a lot of experiences that they're having now that they're engaged in that fight that are complicated and fraught. So among them is discovering that in this fight, they have participated in the subjugation of many of the women who, in fact, have done the work of leading resistance movements long before many of these white women became politically activated. And they're coming face to face with some of the anger at them for having been sitting on the sidelines while other women have fought, for having been profiting from, as white women who benefit from and often are asked to and do defend white supremacy, the damage that those white women have done to other women. These are difficult conversations, but they're necessary if we want to move forward. Women who have previously been politically disengaged and are now active and energized within protest movements, within political campaigns, even in the act of telling their stories, are also coming face to face with the reality that many people are discounting them, not believing them, not listening to them, not respecting them, and that can feel incredibly frustrating. That is one of the mechanisms that causes women to not voice their fury, is the realization that they won't be taken seriously or heard. And I think the other thing is that it's people coming face to face with the fact that there are losses and that you can't just win this fight quickly. And one of the activists in Good and Mad who spoke to me actually described working with sort of newly activated women of color who were like, well, we'll have a town hall and we'll get our politicians to listen to us. And the activists who've been fighting for decades are like, what makes you think they're going to listen to us? You know, what makes you think that that would make a difference? But the women who were coming from a position of power assumed that lawmakers would listen to them. And I think that that's a fascinating sort of view of how different groups understand their own power and how people are going to respond to it. And I think that the fact that you can be so angry and you can dedicate your every day and every hour to resisting power abuses, and yet that power may still get abused, you may not win that immediate fight. I think that's a lesson that a lot of women are learning, and that's extremely difficult to learn. You know, the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh is a direct example of this. I think there's every reason to believe, we're recording this a few days before he may be confirmed. I think there are lots of reasons to believe he will be confirmed. Mm-hmm. And that for a lot of the women who have been strenuously objecting to it, that can feel like a defeat. But what we have to acknowledge is that the process of agitating for change and a disruption of a power structure and its abuses entails a lot of losses. And that the fight is a long-term one. And that in fact, when you sign up to do this hard work, you're signing up for often a lifetime spent engaged in a fight, and you may not live to see a win. And yet, we are here because generations before us also spent their lives working toward victories that many of them did not ever live to see, but which we now benefit from.
And that generational view of time that you talk about and you write about, I think is so, you know, in some way, that short-term, immediate view of time and view of, you know, short-term gain, short-term loss is a patriarchal construct. And, you know, I think of it as a longer view having sometimes a more feminine, I don't know.
I don't know that it's more, that the taking the long view is attached to gender as much as we think. I think that the steep risks of this moment have brought a long view of history and future into stark relief on both the right and the left, for both the historically powerful and the historically less powerful. I think that on the side of the subjugated and oppressed majority, that is the United States, everybody who is not part of a white patriarchy, or who objects to the abuses of a white patriarchy in this country, I think the view is of how long this struggle has taken, or, you know, it will soon be of how long the struggle to get something closer to what was promised at the founding and never yet realized in the United States, which was, you know, liberty and equality and a representative democracy. I think that the view of how long these fights have gone on, extending not just since Election Day 2016 and not just since Anita Hill's testimony in 1991 and not just back to the you know, second wave feminism of the 70s, the civil rights movement, the gay rights movement, but back through the labor movement, the settlement house movement, the abolition and suffrage movements, that this has been going on since the founding, this fight, since an enslaved woman named Mom Bett heard the rhetoric of revolution in her house in Massachusetts and petitioned for her own freedom, applying that rhetoric of liberty and independence to her own circumstance. She won her freedom, and her case became one of the bases for the abolition of slavery in Massachusetts in 1783. You know, from that moment, the struggle to hold an American power structure to the promises of equality and representation on which it founded and built the nation, we are looking at two centuries of that fight to hold America accountable for the thing that it promised we were supposed to be. And I think this is a moment where we are reminded that we are part of that struggle and that we have not gotten over. We have a tremendous instinct in this country to pat ourselves on the back and say, oh, well, we fixed that. The civil rights movement fixed that. The election of Barack Obama fixed racism. you know, more women are in colleges than men at this point. That means we fixed sexism. There's a, and it's hard to be in this fight. So we'd rather say that we fixed it and not be fighting. And I think we've been in a period that's been like that for a couple decades. And the anger has been pushing through that veneer of self-congratulation. You know, again, Occupy, slut walks, Black Lives Matter. There's been a sort of progressive protest culture and willingness to rage against a power structure that has emerged in the years leading up to now, but now it's sort of in full flower. And on the other side, I think you're looking at a system that longs to tighten its grip deep into the future, and that is what it is trying to do in manipulating a Supreme Court and ensuring that a Supreme Court may undo the very progress that was made by previous eras and in previous eras and by earlier iterations of these social movements, undo things like affirmative action and voting rights and reproductive rights and collective bargaining rights. All the sort of products of those labor, civil rights, women's movements can be undone legally in the Supreme Court. And that's in part what a white patriarchy that is clinging to its own power is trying to do by ensuring that it has a court that's ultimately going to defend that power. And that's the crux of where we are, with those who have historically had this grip of on power looking forward and imagining how they might best extend that grip. And those who have been trying to challenge and loosen that grip on power from the outside, suddenly reminded of how we are still very in the midst of that struggle and that it has not been finished.
At this moment, with the election of Trump, we see, you know, it strikes me. My husband and I had a conversation the other day about his press conference. It was not one that brought a lot of. I don't think many people were talking about it, but he was in the Rose Garden, and there was a female reporter. Before she even got her question out, there was, you know, the panel of white guys behind him kind of glaring and jeering. And it was just misogyny is just, you know, unfettered. That's just one of many examples. But we're at this moment where it's just really been released and very, you know, I think it was always seething under the surface, and now we're really experiencing the full bloom of it. And certainly it's emboldening that here in this country, and I think globally, mm-hmm. it's activating yeah. that side of us, and I guess for the full expanse of your career as a feminist writer and journalist, where do you see the battle for hearts and minds? Like what's your fear at this moment, and what's your hope at this moment?
I don't think that things like misogyny and racism have been newly activated in this mm-hmm. period. I think they have been revealed for what they've always been. And I think that that's a crucial distinction. One of the things that's, what is happening is that the battle lines are becoming more starkly drawn. There's no denying at this point that there is this battle. And that for a long time, those who were clearly building up a political party and supporting policy that was misogynistic, racist, and xenophobic in its demands and in its effects, dressed up a lot of those impulses as being about being woman-friendly, and you know there was an effort to conceal those impulses under. Some of the partisan drive coming from the right. Like, they weren't anti-woman, they certainly weren't racist. And I think that what Donald Trump has done is sort of just pulled the curtain off of all of that. And that, in fact, his success permitted others in his party to pull a curtain off. Because while he was running, there was this idea that he was saying these things, he was calling Mexicans rapists. He ran on a racist, he built his political profile on a racist conspiracy theory that Barack Obama was illegitimate because he was not born in the United States. That was just open racism, and that's how Donald Trump's political career took root. He called women pigs and dogs and was recorded on tape, you know, saying that he grabbed them against their will. And lots of people speculated, you know, would he be able to win despite this, that this kind of rhetoric was disqualifying. And one of the things that I think people in his party saw, and that lots of us are seeing, is that he was winning because of this, that this isn't some disqualifying aberration, that this is, in fact, a kind of rhetoric and set of beliefs about who should how people should be treated and what kinds of biases and hatreds are valid and permissible, and that has a real reach and appeal to some large percentage of this country. And that's the revelation of this time. It's not a new rebirth of racism or misogyny. It is it's being revealed to us in a way that should have been obvious for a long time, but for a lot of people, we could pretend that it wasn't there anymore and that it had been covered up. So the stakes are really high at this point because it's very clear what side everybody's fighting on. Donald Trump and the Republicans have just gone, they've doubled down on, there's no trying to pretty up the fact that what they're saying is that women's objections to the further accumulation of power by those who've abused it are invalid and shouldn't stand in the way of that accumulation of power, that women's stories don't count, that women yelling and protesting are loudmouths and hysterics who should not be taken seriously. This is all stuff said by senators and the President of the United States within the past couple of weeks, and there's no secrecy about it anymore. So the stakes are high, but they've always been high. The only good thing I can say about this is that there's no denying what those stakes are. There's no denying what's on the table right now. What has been revealed to us, you know, over the past couple of weeks and months and years is the connection between a disregard for women and the kinds of policies that would limit those women's autonomy, you know, reproductive rights, and thus their, you know, economic, familial, social, professional power. The link between that and the kind of, and the people who think that having perhaps assaulted a woman sexually, whether you're talking about Donald Trump or Brett Kavanaugh, shouldn't be disqualifying as they try to attain a job or an office in which they'll have even more power to make laws about women's bodies. For instance, that's just one of the strains of things that has been revealed to us. And so it makes it much more obvious what we're fighting for and much more undeniable what we're fighting about. As far as what my hopes are, I mean, my hopes are that the power structure on which this country has always been built, which is a white capitalist patriarchal power structure, is effectively challenged and broken. But that's a long-term project, and people have been working at it for centuries. And so I think, and the ask that, like, we're just going to break it apart and fix it, you know, at the midterms is wildly unrealistic. And, you know, I think that part of it is reminding people that being engaged in this fight is necessary, urgent, and correct in this moment as it has always been. And that the aberration is when we weren't engaging in the fight. Mm-hmm. When we were acting as though this fight wasn't real and this wasn't what was at stake and we could sit on our couches and be apathetic. That was the aberration in this country's history, and that this is the correct fight to be in at this moment.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. I want to talk about the joys. Mm-hmm. Anger, the joys of anger, the joys of sisterhood. You had a chapter on about sisterhood. And I think that that's something we don't ever talk about. We talk about the pain of anger.
Right. We talk about anger as an inherently ugly and divisive and confrontational force. And of course it can be. I'm not denying that it is. But we don't value it for its release, for the relief of expressing it, for the joy and the ability to be offered a full range of human expression for people who've long been discouraged from expressing their anger, and also the power of anger to connect women to each other. One of the costs of the suppression of anger in women is that we wind up isolated. If we swallow our fury and we don't give voice to it, we often wind up feeling like we're the only ones who are experiencing that we're alone in our frustrations and odd and weird and different. But when you give voice to the things you're angry or resentful about, and you become audible to other women who might feel the same way, and have also felt previously isolated, but might have lived down the block from you. And then once you become audible to each other, you can be connected and you can communicate with each other and you can share your frustrations. And there is a joy of connection and communion in that. There is also the possibility for organizing and coalition, which is, of course, the politically strategic reason why a power structure wants to suppress that rage in women. Because if you don't know that the woman down the street from you is as angry as you are, then there's no chance you're going to start, you know, organizing or running for office together. And so I think that we need to talk more about anger as a connector between people, and one that does offer them a chance at joyful affiliation and the relief of feeling not alone in the world.
That you painted a really beautiful picture of the second wave feminism. There was a quote about, I feel the in the loose embrace of feminism, I feel this collective relief from silence. And
that's the writer Vivian Gornick, who is a feminist essayist and beautiful writer and activist during second wave feminism, wrote so gorgeously about the bliss of having been engaged in the women's movement at the height of it in the 1970s, and being with these other women, and feeling such love, connection, and energy with them. She says, not an I love you in the world could touch it. And amazingly, I heard that sentiment echoed from women that I spoke to in the suburbs, women who'd never been politically engaged before, who'd become politically engaged within the past couple of years, who talked about how in some cases their level of political activism is imperiling some of their previous relationships, which they'd been, you know, with husbands or partners or friends who'd known them as sort of politically disengaged and apathetic, and now they're spending their every waking moment, you know, canvassing, door knocking, registering voters, or running for office, or striking, and it's imperiling some of their relationships. And I had women say to me, like, but that's okay, this is who I am now. Mm-hmm. And the relationships from my old life, they're either gonna need to adjust, you know, or change, because this is who I am, and I'm feeling more myself and with my sisters. You know, one of these women said, my sisters are here. This is where my community and, you know, a version of myself that feels more fully realized than any I've ever known before. It's with these people who are with me in this battle. And there's an echo of that bliss that Vivian Gornick described.
Yeah, and it's a vision that we don't talk about.
Right.
You know, I often long for the days of the beloved community when there was such a community that supported civic engagement and that there was, you know, training and...
Well, I think, you know, that one of the things to remember is that those communities have existed,
right.
Especially, you know, amongst activists of color, the ones people who have always been leading, who have been working together, who are the foot soldiers of the Democratic Party, which pays them no respect, either in terms of policy or communication. It's often in Black communities that you see the most reliable engagement around politics, and always have. It's often the communities that have been more affluent and enjoyed degrees of privilege, including white supremacy, that have been the ones that lost that community.
Yeah.
And didn't have it because their apathy was encouraged.
When you parent, you and your husband, mm-hmm. you parent your young children, you, the personal is political, how you set up your family in this, you know, larger society that we're all part of.
You mean in terms of the division of domestic responsibility,
no,
or how we talk about politics?
No, just simpler than that. How do you raise your kids in this moment, in this culture, knowing what you know, knowing what your husband knows, and the work you guys both do? What are you doing that's helping to inoculate, maybe that's the wrong word, that's helping them to deal with this or change how they hear things? I don't know.
I think if there's anything that we try to inoculate them against, it's from the message that they can afford to be disengaged.
Mm-hmm.
And it is tricky with young kids to offer them the information and perspective that we want them to have without putting the weight of the world on their shoulders,
mm-hmm.
right? And so I don't know that I'm notoriously bad at giving any parenting advice because we are very honest. I have a 3.5-year-old and a 7-year-old. And obviously at this point, this applies much more to the 7-year-old who's more engaged in the kind of work we do. I write about politics. I write about women in politics. I write about race. I write about economic inequality. My husband's a public defender. So we both do work that is sort of gets to the heart of so many inequalities in this country. And I think that mostly to the degree that we have any kind of policy about it, it's that we're pretty honest with them. We speak very honestly about what we do, and we speak quite honestly about the news. We try not to tell them things that are actually going to scare them needlessly. But we do. We talk about politics at our dinner table every night. We talk about inequality all the time. We talk about we talk about everything. Yeah. And you know, we try to do it in a way that doesn't terrify. But I also think that it is a tremendous, you know, trying to think of how to say this. There are so many kids for whom the realities of inequality, incarceration, police violence, misogyny, domestic violence are their lived experience, that it seems to me misguided to think that I don't know if I'm saying this right. I actually don't know how to say this, but I think it's, I mean, I tell my kids about the world because there are millions of their peers who are born knowing about the inequalities of the world. And if I'm raising kids who are in some way insulated from those inequalities, then I'm not, I view it as my responsibility to make them aware of them from birth. Non-white kids in America grow up knowing about race from birth, because we assume that only kids who are non-white have race, but white kids have race too, right. And enjoy racial privilege. And we sure as hell better be teaching them about that from the beginning. Right. I mean, the idea that we somehow have to be careful or perhaps shield white kids from real conversations about race or racial violence or inequality or privilege, again, just reaffirms this incorrect notion that race is something that belongs only to people who are not white. And in fact, it is incumbent on white Americans to acknowledge the degree to which they are raced as well, and the degree to which we enjoy privileges and, in fact, participate in the racial oppression, even if it's not directly, that we benefit from racial inequality, and that it better be made as clear to my white kids as it is from birth to kids who are not white.
If you'd like to hear more from Rebecca Traister, follow her on Twitter at rtraister. Read her columns in New York Magazine. And most of all, if you're mad, go get yourself a copy of Good and Mad from your local library to make sense of it all and to take your place among the long lineage of fighters for justice. Links to everything can be found at our website, 3ms.co. That's the number 3, the letters ms.co. And while you're there, subscribe to our mailing list so you never miss a story from us.